Take back the city for yourself tonight. I'll take back the city for me. Take back the city for yourself tonight. Whoa, whoa.
Welcome to Third Paradigm, an out-of-the-box think tank about community sovereignty and regenerative economics. We look at how to take back our cities, farmland, and water, our money, production, and trade, our media, education, and culture, our religion, and even our God. We present a people's history of the Bible and a parent's view on how to raise giving kids in a taking world. I'm your host, Teresa Caraggio, broadcasting through Free Radio Santa Cruz, WHCL Hamilton College, and Upstart Radio Online. Welcome to the 27th episode of Third Paradigm. Our title this week is Muslim is the New Jew, Christianity and Torture. We'll examine some survey data from the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life, and then we'll hear some Al Jazeera audio from Bagram Air Force Base. Is it an accurate reading or a misinterpretation that the Bible is considered compatible with torture for the majority of Christians? Does it say something about us, or indicate a contradiction built into the very foundations on which this house is built? We'll also look at the moral code for Judeo-Christianity, the Ten Commandments. I've heard it said that after three millennia, the Ten Commandments still can't be improved on. I beg to differ, and so I'll take my own shot at it. But first, we'll read a poem, Hope by Liesl Mueller. The music is Soft Temple from the Grails. Hope. It hovers in dark corners before the lights are turned on. It shakes sleep from its eyes and drops from mushroom gills. It explodes in the starry heads of dandelions turned sages. It sticks to the wings of green angels that sail from the tops of maples. It sprouts in each occluded eye of the many-eyed potato. It lives in each earthworm segment, surviving cruelty. It is the motion that runs the tail of a dog. It is the mouth that inflates the lungs of the child that has just been born. It is the singular gift we cannot destroy in ourselves. The argument that refutes death. The genius that invents the future. All we know of God. It is the serum which makes us swear not to betray one another. It is in this poem trying to speak. That was Liesl Mueller with Hope. The music was The Grails with Soft Temple from their Burning Off Impurities CD. And now I'd like to continue the conversation I'm having in my mind with the alternative media. On David Barsamian's alternative radio this week, Frances Moore LaPaix gave a fascinating speech about the work of Hope. She's a beautiful speaker with a nice understated style. She's also the founder of one of my favorite organizations, Food First in Oakland. The detail that struck me was an incidental fun fact, that the game of Monopoly was developed by a Quaker woman as an illustration of the destructiveness of capitalism. As players go around and around, whoever has an early combination of dumb luck and ruthless ambition will continue to compound that advantage at the expense of the other players. There's no invisible hand of the market that evens things out, giving a boost to the underdog or tempering the rapacious appetite of high rollers. The game doesn't end until it reaches its natural conclusion. One person left with 100% of the money and assets. Illustrating this principle, Parker Brothers usurped the game and marketed it without a sense of irony. Generations have now grown up emulating the tycoons and moving up the corporate and government ladders with pride. At this point, 1% of the U.S. population is said to own 90% of the wealth. How long are we going to wait to change the rules of the game? 95%? 99%? 100% game over? In a previous episode called The Sovereignty Game, I suggested that we use the same paradigm to model different sets of economic rules. The game can only be won collectively. In Monopoly, everyone starts out the same, but it ends when you've reached the maximum discrepancy. One person with everything, everyone else with nothing. In Sovereignty, different players would represent people with wildly divergent starting places. The game is won by getting these groups to tend towards the middle with each successive round. Which role you play depends on a roll of the die. Last week, we talked about the tax havens, a major way in which the dice are loaded. I quoted estimates that the U.S. loses from $210 billion to $1 trillion in tax revenues over the course of a decade. But developing countries lose from $850 billion to $1 trillion a year. In the sovereignty game, this would be a rule where you could take money off the table and out of the game, and give it to a phantom player, where it could only gain and never diminish. It just so happens that the shadow player's address is the player's pocket. But they, the phantom corporation, carry any liabilities while the player pockets any gains. Now, thanks to the shadow puppet Obama, we're looking at a free trade agreement with one of the leading tax evasion and drug money havens, Panama. This Monopoly game rule will enable the players who represent Caterpillar to bid on canal expansion projects, Citibank to invest that drug money in mutual funds, and Big Pharma and Big Ag to shake down sick Panamanians while they force GMOs down their throats and grab their land. This would not only not be a formula that wins the sovereignty game. And the advocates admit that the benefit to the U.S. will be negligible. To demonstrate how easy it is to set up a Panamanian shell corporation, Public Citizens Global Trade Watch had one of their interns, a college sophomore, call a Panamanian bank. Let's hear how it went.
Hi, I'm wondering if I might be able to speak with you about setting up an offshore company.
Okay, so I guess the first thing I would need is a photocopy of your passport and some kind of a reference letter. It could be a bank reference letter. Doesn't have to be issued in our name. Okay. And also some information as to your professional activity, as well as what the intended use of the company is.
Is that all you need?
Yes, that's all I would need.
I understand that there are some tax benefits to setting up a corporation in Panama. Could you explain this to me?
Okay, well, Panamanian corporations basically pay no taxes on any foreign-derived income. So if you set up a Panamanian corporation, any income that comes into that corporation is not business-related to here in Panama. It doesn't have to pay any taxes.
Nothing?
Nothing.
What's the privacy policy? What kind of information could possibly be handed over to U.S. authorities?
Well, the way we set it up as a bearer share corporation for you, which means that basically in the public registry and everywhere, your name is nowhere. So from there, you already have protection behind the corporate structure. Then when you have your money in the bank account, you're protected by the strictest banking secrecy laws in the world, which is Panama, totally removing you from the legal trail.
Do you expect any of this to change because of the proposed free trade agreement with Panama?
If they were going to make any change, like I said, it would have to be two changes. It would have to be in all the banking laws, which is like the biggest We have the biggest banking industry in the world, really. We have like over 100 banks and we're only 3 million citizens. They'd have to change all of that. It would take a while. And then if that was going to be changed, then they would have to change the whole legal structure of how Panama works. So I don't see any of that happening, you know, for years. I mean, they'd have to change the way everything works here in Panama.
How quickly would I be able to set up an offshore company?
The setting up of the offshore company and registration of the corporation itself takes 72 hours from the moment of payment.
To really get the full impact of this video, you have to see it. It starts with pictures of this cute 20-year-old doing the goofy things college sophomores do. She may even still have braces. Then you hear her on the speakerphone with a Panamanian customer service rep who may or may not have a job after this. To see the video, go to the Public Citizen website where it's on the front page. There's also a link to send an automated email to your members of Congress who think that no one cares about trade deals. Unfortunately, they're too often right, so let's change that. To lead into our next section on religion and torture, we'll break for Bruce Coburn with Justice. That was Bruce Coburn with Justice, talking about doing to others that which we would never want done to us. So let's see what Christians think about justice and torture in the latest results from the Pew Forum of Religion and Public Life. They're sort of the Harper's Index on religion, presenting statistics in a just-the-facts-ma'am kind of way. Facts fascinate me because they speak for themselves but make the juxtapositions clear. This month, they asked various denominations of Christians and non-Christians if they thought that torturing a terrorist suspect was justified. The choices were A, often, B, sometimes, C, rarely, and D, never. They found that 62% of white evangelical Protestants believe that torture is often or sometimes justified. White non-Hispanic Catholics came in second, still over half, with 51%. White mainline Protestants came in at 46%. and Torture's lowest approval rating, 40%, was among those unaffiliated with any religion. This is still 2 out of 5 people in the U.S. who believe that torture is often or sometimes justified. This isn't even dodging around what is or isn't torture, but coming right out and using the word. Among the average population, only 1 in 4 people thought that torture was never justified. A Washington Post columnist on faith, Susan Brooks Thistlethwaite, speculated on whether the reason for this is theological, that severe pain and suffering are considered central to the Christian faith, as graphically illustrated in the 40-minute flogging episode in Mel Gibson's Passion of the Christ. Thistlethwaite disagrees with this interpretation of Christianity, but can't otherwise explain how so many Christians could condone torture. But to figure out if this is the reason, the Pew Forum needs to follow up with another question. Is it ever justified for someone from another country to torture American soldiers? Would the same percentage of each denomination say often, sometimes, rarely, and never? If not, the Christian martyrdom syndrome can't explain it. It's not an obsession with pain and suffering if it doesn't apply to us. What would you guess? I'd say that less than 1% would say torture of American soldiers was often or sometimes justified, and 90% would say never. What's the difference between our soldiers and their terrorists? If you kill civilians using high-tech weapons at little or no risk to yourself, you're a peacekeeper. If you attack armed invaders using rocks or homemade weapons at extreme risk to yourself, you're a terrorist. In the U.S. legal code, they say that terrorism can't be defined without first describing the actor, which is how a double standard works. Our soldiers are engaged in the same activities as their terrorists, except we have drones so we can get back to our kids' softball game in between. So why do Americans, especially evangelicals and Catholics, think it's okay for us to torture them, but if they were to torture us, it would prove that they were depraved heathens? Curiously, justifying torture goes up the more often one attends religious services. 42% of those who attend seldom or never say that torture is often or sometimes justified. Of those who attend a few services a year, the Christmas and Easter crowd, 51% say it is. And of those who attend weekly, 54% believe there's a time for torture. As Ecclesiastes 3:8 says, a time to love and a time to hate, a time for peace and a time for war, a time to make casseroles for the potluck, and a time to go to the dungeons and torture. The Pew study came out at the same time as the Al Jazeera footage of army chaplains at Bagram telling soldiers to hunt souls down for Jesus and get the hound of heaven after them. Let's hear the clip.
All of you, if you name the name of Christ, are commissioned to be witnesses for him. You said, does that mean we all preachers?
Mm-hmm. The man giving this sermon, the chief of the chaplains in Afghanistan, Lieutenant Colonel Gary Hensley. He tells the congregation, all of them servicemen and women, that they need to go on a recruiting drive for the faith.
The special forces guys, they hunt men, basically. We do the same thing as Christians. We hunt people for Jesus. We do. We hunt them down. Get the hound of heaven after them. So we get them in the kingdom. Right? That's what we do. That's our business.
That was the chaplain at Bagram as played on Al Jazeera. Bagram, of course, isn't just an Air Force base. It's where Taxi to the Dark Side took place, the story of Dilawar, a 22-year-old taxi driver that the interrogators had even believed to be innocent, but tortured to death anyway for their own amusement. It seemed that every time they struck him, he cried Allah. And so, as a running joke, they did it over and over, 100 times in 24 hours. Habibullah was another detainee who died while being tethered to the ceiling by handcuffs and beaten. The evangelical chaplains might as well be wearing the robes of the crusaders or conquistadors or inquisitors. It's time to take a hard look at why the Bible lends itself to the cause of torture. What makes it a tool that fits nicely into the hands of the oppressor, but hasn't created a community that's against the most heinous and immoral act that's humanly possible. In Imperial County, California, 14-year-old Explorer Scouts deal out justice to hostage-taking terrorists, disgruntled Iraqi vets, marijuana growers, or border-crossing immigrants. Pete Bianco, who rebroadcast Third Paradigm at WHCL Hamilton College, sent me this article from the New York Times. Clad in khaki and armed with compressed air pellet guns, co-ed scouts simulate border patrols and taking out active shooters. They also shoot real guns on a closed range. "I like shooting them," a 16-year-old girl said. "I like the sound they make. It gets me excited." It gets a few police leaders excited, too, since there have been numerous cases of sexual abuse reported over the years. But now leaders are required to take an online training course on sexual misconduct. For kids to qualify for the program, they need to be 14 and have a C average, although these have wiggle room. Thousands of scouts train for competitions in which they're judged by the lightning speed in which they can inflict violence based on snap decisions. For my youngest daughter, I found the Brownie Pledge to be too Youth for Hitler for my taste and couldn't sign her up, although I loved the leader and the group. My oldest daughter was in marching band, but the color guard dancing with faux rifles made me sick to my stomach. "Oh, look, they're twirling and tossing lethal weapons tied with pretty scarves. Isn't that precious?" I don't understand why I seem to be the only parent with this gut reaction, while everyone else bakes non-fair trade cupcakes to send them to Disneyland. And so, since we seem to have misplaced our moral compass, I'd like to propose a new version of the Ten Commandments. Number 1. Thou shalt not maim, terrorize, or torture. Never, ever, not ever. 2. Thou shalt not kill unless it's the only way to prevent greater harm. 3. Thou shalt not make, ship, or fund weapons of indiscriminate destruction. 4. Thou shalt not invade, occupy, enslave, or steal resources. 5. Don't do unto others what you wouldn't want done to you. 6. Tell the truth, especially when it comes to history. 7. Respect those who came before and protect the earth for those yet to come. 8. Give everyone the benefit of the doubt. 9. Play fair. And 10. Leave the world a little kinder than you found it. In closing, we'll hear a rap song from a marathon-running Tibetan Buddhist Lama, Sakyong Mifam. His contemplation for today is that true relaxation suggests a deep underlying confidence in our enlightened nature. It also, perhaps, reflects a deep underlying confidence in the enlightenment readiness of others. This has been Enlightenment Ready, Teresa Caraggio with Third Paradigm. Thanks to Skidmark Bob for production, editing, and music suggestions. Thanks also to Joan Lintz Thompson for designing a gorgeous logo for Third Paradigm, which we hope to show off on our new website soon. Then we can also show the video with Sakyong's beautiful smile. Isn't that a prerequisite for being a Buddhist monk? This is Mi Pham with What About Me?
What about me? That's my first thought every morning. What happened to me is the last thought every night. Has this gotten me anywhere? Any more friends? Any more love? More joy? It should have by now. In fact, by now, I should be a bundle of joy. Because I say this mantra every day. In fact, say this mantra all day long, like the beating of my heart. What about me? What about me? Shower, I think, what about me? I hope this shower makes me feel happy. I hope this kiss makes me feel happy. I hope this lunch makes me happy. I hope these clothes make me feel happy. I hope this donut, this cup of coffee, this new affair, this new job.
What about me?
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 What about me? This new spiritual practice, this new movie, this new CD. This new CD will make you happy, 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 happy. Will make you happy.
What about
happy?
What about me?
That's my first thought every morning.
What about me?
What happens to me?
What about me?
Is my last thought every night? Has this got me
any more love? Any more joy?
Makes me happy. You know what? None of it will make you happy unless you do one simple thing. Change me for you. Change me for you. Let's wake up in the morning and try something wild. Just break up the monotony. Say, may you be happy. May you be happy. May you be happy.
What about you?
That's my first thought every morning.
What about you?
What happened to you?
What about you?
It's the last thought every night. This has given me
so much more love, so much more joy.
Take a shower, make my bed when I dance, make you happy. When I give you the remote control, make you happy. When I sit on a park bench by myself, when I feel the sun and the breeze, make you happy. When I just look at you, stare into your eyes. Make you happy. And you know what? When you're happy, I'm happy. That's the formula. First you, then me. That's all happiness is. It's just the heart being free.